On June 25th, earlier this year, in nearly 2,000 locations across the U.S., activists took to the streets to voice their concerns about economic inequality, corporate influence in politics, systemic racism, social justice, environmental issues, political accountability, and probably a host of other things as well. Now, two words described these protests. They were written on picket signs. People were chanting the mantra through the street. Do you know what those two words were? No kings. Now, I'm not interested in cutting through the fog of our current socio-political environment. I'm not interested in advocating or denouncing the rallies. Some of you are already like, you're worked up. Is this CNN or Fox News we're getting this morning? No, I just want to focus on the motto of the movement. No thrones, no crowns, no kings. Step away from your political persuasion and the tenuous partisan environment we're in just for a second and think about the claim. In America, we don't do kings. Now, I know I'm asking you to decontextualize something that's highly volatile, but I'm doing that because I don't think it's merely a political sentiment of some. I think it's at the core of all of our hearts. Somewhere deep inside, at some point in your life, there has been a raging cry that says, no thrones, no crowns, no kings. We don't do kings. Well, in the opening of this psalm, you almost hear that echo, don't you? These first few verses, I just call it widespread rebellion. It's just what you see in the rage of a sinful heart against a holy God. The author begins by identifying kind of this internal angst. I'm squeezing my fist because I want you to feel it inside. It's this rage inside of anti-authoritarianism. The psalmist looks across humanity and he sees the violent shaking of picket signs and he hears the loud screamings for autonomy, freedom, self-rule. You almost hear the echoes of contemporary picket signs. Look at verses 1 through 3. Just see if you can hear these echoes in verses 1 through 3. Why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth set themselves. The rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us burst their bonds apart and cast away their cords from us. In other words, we don't need to be ruled. We don't want constraints. We're done with harnesses and yokes. Now, it's important to note in the opening of this text, the psalmist doesn't see this as a problem of just a few people. No, he thinks this is all of humanity. You see it in these descriptive words. In verses 1 through 3, you see words like the nations, plural, the peoples, the kings, the rulers. By the time you get to the last verse, skip all the way to the last verse of the psalm and look at verse number 12, the very last line. Blessed are all who take refuge in him. In other words, the psalmist isn't pointing this at a select few. He's looking to all of us. At one point or another, all of humanity has set themselves against God and his anointed one. This is widespread rebellion. And quite frankly, it has a long history, doesn't it? I mean, here we are in the middle of our Bible, but if you flip back to the very first pages, what do you find there? I mean, all the way back to Adam and Eve, our first parents, what do we find them doing in Genesis chapter 3? They're taking counsel together against the Lord, aren't they? That's what they're doing. They're conspiring about their own way. They're plotting a scheme to do their own thing and throw off God's rule. And sadly, every generation since then has followed suit. If you want the blunt truth, listen to what Paul says about humanity. Here it is, Romans chapter 3. Just these little selections from Romans 3. No one seeks for God. All have turned aside. The way of peace they have not known. There is no fear of God before their eyes. In other words, here's what Paul is saying. Whether you trek 5 days into the jungle or you ride 5 stops on a Tokyo subway, the people you encounter are set against God. Rebellion isn't local or national. This is what the psalmist is saying. It's universal. I mean, just pause for a second. Can you think of a time when the imposition of God's rule intersected with your will? Can you think of a time you wanted something? You wanted your way. This is what you thought was best for you. And then here came God's word, and the two collided. Like a head-on collision on a highway. God's will, your will. Have you ever felt an internal sense of rebellion? Like God begins to speak to you in a sensitive area of your life. He starts to speak to you about sexual purity or financial generosity or neighborly love or marital fidelity or self-denial, and the list could go on and on. And God begins to touch that one nerve in your heart. Like Jesus touched the nerve of the rich young ruler when he said, go ahead and sell all that you have. He just touched the nerve. Has God ever touched the nerve of your heart? You felt the imposition of his will, and it was contrary to your own. And what you discovered is that welling up inside of you was a sense of, shh, don't tell anyone, rebellion. You didn't want God's rule in your life. Now, the psalmist uses colorful words to describe this. He says in verse number 1, it's a rage. I mean, think about something that's simmering, gurgling, boiling, tossing inside. Rage is used in the Old Testament. The same Hebrew word is used to picture a stormy sea. Think about Jonah in that ship as he ran away from the Lord and the stormy, raging sea, like the Atlantic during hurricane season. Hearts are troubled when they think about a God who rules them. They rage. I've had this experience on a few occasions. I mean, I think I'm a fairly nice person, usually. I smile a lot. Actually, when I went to officer training school for the Air Force, I got yelled at for smiling. You think this is funny, counterman? And I'm like, no, yes. I feel like I'm fairly nice, but there have been these occasions where I've tried to talk to someone about God only to get an immediate response of anger. Have you ever had that? I mean, you're just trying to share Jesus. You're trying to testify about your Savior. You're trying to tell about a good God. But their response is one of just fury. Don't talk to me about that. Stop trying to push your religion on me. I don't believe in that stuff. And all of a sudden, I mean, they're just getting, like, the temperature's rising. I've often wondered why atheists can get so emotional about the mention of God. I mean, if he's non-existent, how does he threaten your peace so much? I think it's just, listen, I think fundamentally, it's just this idea of rule or lordship or authority or creator rights. And that makes the heart rage. The text uses the word rage to describe this rebellion. Notice also these rebels are plotting. Verse number one, they're plotting together. Or in verse two, they're taking counsel together against the Lord. The picture I have here are these, you know, these devilish fiends, like Falcone's thugs in Batman. And they're wringing their hands and they're whispering these villainous schemes. I mean, they're conspiring and they're plotting against the Lord. And that's how I picture, at least at first, those who rebel. And I think I like that picture of rebels, like hooligans, Gotham City, the crime district, those people over there. I kind of like that picture of rebels because maybe it distances rebellion from me. Friends, rebels, however, aren't just raging people. They can also be rebellious people who mask it in religion. So they could be religious people. They could even be indifferent people. Rebellion takes on all sorts of forms. And I want you to think this morning, what is your form of rebellion? I'm assuming that you're rebellious in some way when you've encountered God's law because the psalmist seems to indicate that's what humanity feels at some juncture. So when you're rebellious, what form does it take? It's not just rage. Do you know sometimes the biggest rebels are religious people? They've figured out that the way to stay away from the police is to follow the rules. So they try to do that with Jesus. They try to be pretty good, fairly moral, moderately upstanding. They try to use their morality to avoid the Lord. If they can just, I mean, think about it this way. If they can just be good enough, then they don't need a savior. If they can just tap into some self-help, then they don't have to go through the humiliation of being rescued. And so they rebel in their morality. There are others, though, who rebel just by simply ignoring God. They want to sidestep their need for him. Maybe there is a God, maybe not. Who knows? Maybe we can't figure it out. I just like to live and let live. Friends, independence from your Creator is delusional. You're not your own. You've been bought with a price. You were made to glorify God. So if you ignore your Creator, you're actually rebelling against your Creator. We don't like to think about that because, quite frankly, I wonder how many days go by when we ignore our Creator. Like you get to the end of the day, you worked all day, you went to school, you did this, you did that, the house chores are done, and you never thought about God all day. The one who made you, the one who made you so that you would glorify him, you just ignored. Friend, do you know ignoring God is rebellion? I think we could see it this way. Go visit Walmart with me. We're in aisle 46. It's the candy aisle. I'm making that up because I have no idea where the candy aisle is. Aisle 46, it's the candy aisle, and you see a mom there with her shopping cart full, and then you see a 7-year-old boy in the candy aisle, and he sees something he wants. It's those Nerd clusters. Anybody in the room like those? Yes, yeah, they're bad for you, good for you. This little seven-year-old sees nerd clusters, and mom knows where his eyes have gone, and she's like, no, 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 we're not getting any candy today. He clearly heard mom, but he walks directly over to the nerd clusters. He picks up the bag. She says, no, we're not getting any of those, walks right past her and throws them in the cart. He ignored her. He rebelled against her. Do you see that? And some days, that's what we do. We like to think it was nothing. I just forgot. No, no, no. We live for his glory. This is what it says in Isaiah 43:7, whom I have created for my glory. I have formed him. Yes, I have made him. Revelation 4:11, you are worthy, O Lord, to receive glory, honor, and power because you made all things, and for your pleasure they are and were created. You were created for his glory. You can't rage against him. That's rebellion. You can't try to use religion to sidestep your need for him. That's rebellion. You can't ignore him. That's rebellion. The psalmist here looks across humanity. What he sees are people who are just sadly rebellious. They feel constrained and bound, and they don't want God's rule. You've heard of restless leg syndrome. Rebellious people have restless life syndrome. They're like a 350-pound, 6'4" bodybuilder stuck in economy class in the middle seat for an international flight. Are you getting the picture? They just want to get out. And that's how some people feel about God. They don't want his constraints. They don't want his commands. They don't want his rule. They just want to throw off the ropes, throw off the fetters. They don't want to be mastered or owned. Look at verse number 3 for the summary statement of rebels. Let us burst their bonds apart and cast away their cords from us. The psalmist identifies widespread rebellion. It's what we see all around us. And maybe it's what we see inside of us. But what are we supposed to do about that? The nations rage, haters gonna hate. So now what? Well, thankfully, the story doesn't end with rebels. The psalmist shifts our focus from rebels to a ruling king. Notice how the text moves from widespread rebellion to God's ultimate sovereignty. Yeah, I know when you look out there, all you see is widespread rebellion, but what truly is, what's real, is that he is the sovereign king. Plotting, raging, conspiring, rebellion. Yes, I know that happens down here. But God is sitting on his throne, laughing up there. The contrast shifting here in verse number 4 is both intentional and pronounced. There may be, it says verse number 2, do you notice how it qualifies the kings in verse 2? They're called kings of the earth. But when you get to verse number 4, it's the king of heaven. He's the one who always gets the last word. Look at verse 4. He who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord holds them in derision. It's like an 18-month squirming to get out of his dad's arms. Have you ever seen a kid that just wants to get down? But the dad knows that wouldn't be best for him right now. And so with as much as that child squirms and seeks to break the constraints, the father holds and says, no, I'm in charge here. You're staying right here. And so God is looking down. He's the king of heaven. Actually, in the Psalms, it refers to him as the great king over all the earth, Psalm 47. He's the king of the nations, Revelation 15. He removes kings and sets up kings, Daniel 2. He is the true sovereign. So even though people rage, he continues to rule. I love the picture. Look at verse number 4. Notice the posture of our heavenly king. Look in verse 4. Do you see it there? He's pacing up in heaven because he's very nervous. He's biting his nails because he's not sure what's going to happen with all the raging rebellion down here. He's having a panic attack. He's very anxious. He can't eat or sleep. Is that what's going on in verse 4? No, look at the sovereign one. He's just sitting there. He's not alarmed. He's not anxious. He's the unmoved mover who's in complete control. The chaos of this world, the threats of the wicked, the loud barks of tyrants, the practices of governments that are twisted, those don't even make God flinch. Now, I think this is important for all of you who are news junkies. Yes, I'm looking at you. News junkies. If you're a news junkie, then whatever you listen to, whichever one you watch, it raises your anxiety. I want to tell you something. The psalmist is saying it's not about the kings down here. It's about the king up there. He sits enthroned. He doesn't flinch at these things that are happening. Some days we feel like the whole globe is going to spin off its axis. We look at the wars that are taking place in different regions of the world. We wonder if sin and corruption is going to win the day. But my friends, this psalm reminds us that all of that chaos is like the yapping of a chihuahua. You know the yapping. There's nothing more fierce or silly. Okay, I have to tell you this. A chihuahua is one of those dogs, which I'm sure some of you love, but I've just never been impressed by. Loud bark, very, very small dog. I thought, they are a very pitiful dog. They have great aspirations in life, which they will never see, you know. Yesterday I saw a three-legged chihuahua, and I'm just telling you, like, my heart was like, oh, I'm so sorry for you. That's how I felt. Listen, all of the yapping and loud barking of all of the things that go on down here are inconsequential when they fade into the background of the great and sovereign king who rules over all. All the evil intentions of this world can't stop God. We could fold through the pages of scripture and see time after time where there were kings and nations that were set against the Lord, and yet he wins in the end. Do you remember a guy named Pharaoh? He wanted to keep God's people in bondage. He wanted to destroy the Israelites. What ends up happening is he cares for Moses and educates him in his own palace, and Moses leads the people out with God's strong arm. Have you heard of a man named Haman? He plotted to destroy the Jews, but was hung on the gallows that he built for someone else. What about the leaders in Israel who hated Jesus and wanted to put him to death on a cross? Well, instead of destroying the Son of God, God used the cross to triumph over sin and save people like us. Paul and Silas, it looks bad for them in the city of Philippi. They're thrown into a dungeon and locked up there. But God uses this, and the Philippian jailer is saved. An emperor named Diocletian set up pillars in Spain, proclaiming victory over Christ. And 7 years later, someone named Constantine made Christianity the official religion of the Roman Empire. The Lord looks down at the plans of the wicked, and he laughs. He mocks them. Verse 4, the Lord holds them in derision. And why is that? Because ultimate sovereignty belongs to him. Now, I've been talking about some of the timeless truths of this text, but I don't want us to forget the original setting. Think back to this psalm being penned and the first audience who read it. According to Acts chapter 4, verse 25, it was David who wrote this psalm. And actually, there are some allusions to the Davidic covenant in this psalm in verses 7 and 8. It's classified as a royal psalm, and it marks the coronation of a king. You see that in places like, look at verse 6. I have set my king on Zion. Think about the coronation of a king. You can also see references to the anointed. Do you see that in verse number 2, the anointed? What does that refer to, the anointed? Well, it refers to a king. Don't you remember how kings became kings in Israel? Like you're thinking back to a guy, he's a prophet named Samuel. He comes to the runt of the litter named David, and he pours oil over him. He anoints him with oil, and he becomes the second king in Israel. Well, the anointed, this is a coronation psalm. It's about the king being put in place. In the original context, David writes this, and he's trying to give Israel hope that even though the nations around Israel would rage against the Lord and the anointed king, ultimately, God would install a future Davidic king who would exercise ultimate authority and be victorious in the end. That's what this psalm was originally for. I mean, think about all the people that Saul had to fight and David had to fight. They had the Moabites and the Ammonites and the Edomites and the Amalekites and the Dynamites and the... I just threw that one in there just to see. Not the Dynamites, they weren't there. They had all these enemies around them. Saul fought them, David fought them. But David writes to the people of Israel and says, wait, there are nations that will rage against us, but God has a plan. There is a coming king, and he will rule to the ends of the earth, and he will be ultimately victorious. That's what this psalm was about in its original context. God would be to this future Davidic king what a father is to a son. There would be relationship. He would give him the rights of inheritance. Authority and rule would go to this one. Notice verse number 8. I will make the nations your heritage and the ends of the earth your possession. One day, even though there are these uprisings, one day, great power will be exerted through a Davidic king, and his reign would be extended to the ends of the earth. That's what David is saying here. He will be ultimately victorious over all evil and all enemies. We see a picture of the victory in verse 9. Look at verse 9. It's this imagery of victory. Verse 9. You shall break them with a rod of iron and dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. What does that mean? We have to understand that in ancient Egypt, the Pharaoh would often take the names of his enemies, put them on clay pots, and set them down. He would pick up an iron rod, and guess what he would do? He'd just destroy these things. There's this, I don't know if it's still there or not. We went with Paul and Courtney once to throw axes. Have anyone in here, it's not at each other. I mean, it's like a... You know, axe throwing. Is there anyone who's ever done that, axe throwing? Okay, so you guys know what I'm talking about. There's one over by Target, and we went over there and did axe throwing. But right next door, we peeked in. I don't know if you remember this, Paul. Right next door, and I don't know if it's still in business. There was this business idea where they would take all of these old electronics, like old TVs and, I don't know, crazy stuff, DVD players, things like that. They had all these, and they would give you those goggles that you had in ninth grade chemistry class. They would give you some of those and a baseball bat and give you a certain amount of time in this room just to destroy everything. I mean, it was like, I don't know. It was like, you know, mind-crushing heavy metal music going on and then just like beating things to death in there. It was like anger, exertion, just, I don't know. It was some sort of therapy, I'm sure. I don't know if the business made it. But that's what I picture here with this. The Pharaoh writes the names of all of his enemies on these clay pots and then takes this big rod of steel and just crushes them. And what David is saying here through that imagery is this: one day all enemies will be crushed. All evil will be put down through a future Davidic king. This king will subjugate opposition, and he will reign victoriously to the ends of the earth. So what have we learned here up through verse number 9? Well, in the face of persistent rebellion, the true king reigns. He's powerful, and he's sovereign over all of his enemies. And at this point, I feel like we should just say this. You know, that sounds really nice. There's a sovereign king who's coming. He's going to put down all evil. He's going to have just judgment. Wrath, fury, anger are going to be meted out against evil and unrighteousness. And that's awesome. I mean, right? Isn't that what you long for? This morning, do you long for immediate and just judgment? Do you long for that? Well, maybe you're like, yes and no. Yes, you want evil to be punished and enemies to be crushed. Unless, of course, there's evil in here. Unless, of course, you're positioning yourself as an enemy of God. Judgment is a funny thing. It's something we always want for others and never for ourselves. Thankfully, the rod of iron hasn't dashed us yet. Do you realize you're here this morning? And one of the evidences of grace is that you are not consumed. The rod of iron has not crushed you yet. Notice in our text a final expression of grace. It's a critical warning that's given here. It's something that you have been given as a gift of God's grace this morning. It's in verse number 10, and it just says this: be wise, be warned. The widespread rebellion isn't being swept under the carpet. The ultimate sovereignty of God is not being negated. It's just that there's a window of amnesty that has been opened for sinners like you and me. This passage brings us to this crossroad of decision. We have rebellion over on this side, and the psalmist wants to be clear. If you continue on the path of rebellion, it will lead to ruin. Look at verse number 12. If you resist the Son, you continue in your stubbornness. Verse 12, you will perish in the way. The way of the ungodly will perish. Rebellion brings ruin, but over here, submission leads to refuge. Look at verse 11. Serve the Lord with fear. Rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son. Down to the very end of verse 12. Blessed are all who take refuge in him. My friends, there is no refuge from him. There is only refuge in him. Now, interestingly, Israel kept waiting and hoping for the promised Davidic king of Psalm chapter 2, one who would rule to the ends of the earth, one who would stop the evil and the enemies of God. Maybe it would be Solomon. Maybe it would be Rehoboam. But they seemed to fit the bill like a five-year-old fits in shoulder pads of an NFL player. No, they just don't match up. They're not all that's spoken of here. They don't meet the descriptions. And so Israel watched one after another of David's descendants until 586 BC when Babylon came in, defeated them, and deported Israel, called Judah at the time, after which there were no more Davidic kings. Well, perhaps rebellion won the day. Maybe this hoped-for sovereign ruler was just an old wives' tale. People could have written off this prophesied king, but what's interesting is that when the Psalms were compiled, you know, you got 150 of these different songs. When they were compiled and put together, what's interesting is that Psalm 2 was put right up front. Isn't that interesting? It's not tucked in the back like Psalm 147. You may never get there. Or Psalm 120. That's the one you never get to. Because Psalm 119 wears you out. It's like, wow, this is the longest chapter ever. It wasn't tucked in back there. No, it was put right up front here. And it's so that people would keep looking for this promised anointed one, this coming king, this son who would come. My friends, it was finally fulfilled in the King of Glory, the King of Kings, namely Jesus. Matthew chapter 1, verse 1, when the New Testament is unfolded here, the very first verse of Matthew 1:1 starts this way, the book of the genealogy of Jesus, the anointed one. Oh, what? We're waiting for an anointed one. Yeah, it's Jesus, the Messiah, or the Christ, the anointed one. And then it says, the son of David. Oh, he's of the Davidic line? Yes. And by the time we get to his baptism, in case you're wondering who this Jesus is, a voice from heaven says, this is my son, the beloved one. Listen to him. Jesus will say this right at the end of his ministry. All authority on heaven and earth has been given unto me. Matthew 28, 18. Go therefore and make disciples of what? All nations. It's almost like his rule would extend to the ends of the earth. It's almost as if Jesus truly is this conquering king. Yes, there's widespread rebellion, but there's ultimate sovereignty that would be displayed in the coming king named Jesus. You have rebels over here, you have a ruler over here, and there's a cross in the middle. I think what the New Testament authors want you to figure out is that you are brought to a choice with Psalm chapter 2. Psalm chapter 2 says, man, there's raging against God. There are people who plot and connive so that they can have their own way. But the Father sent his son Jesus to be king over all, and he is a good king. And you have to make a decision. You've been graciously warned. There's this cross in the middle, and you can either kill the son or kiss the son. Isn't that interesting? You can continue in your rebellion and shout, crucify him, crucify him, no kings. Or you can bow in submission and you can call him Lord, not just Lord over all, but Lord over you. Jesus is the promised Davidic king. He brings you to this point of decision. You either will find ruin or refuge. Escape is found in Jesus. Here's how it's said in the psalm. And I close with this, verse number 11. If you want refuge, you want rescue, verse number 11, then kiss the Son, lest he be angry with you and you perish in the way. Kiss the Son, what does that mean? There's an ancient Near Eastern practice. You can actually go to the British Museum in London today and see what's called the Black Obelisk. It is an archaeological piece that depicts an Israelite king named Jehu bowing before Shalmaneser III, an Assyrian king. And guess what the defeated Israelite king is doing? Guess what he's doing? He's kissing the ground at the feet of the one who conquered him. In other words, it was an ancient Near Eastern practice that showed subservience and submission. You finally bow and you relinquish your will. So here we are at this point of decision. Are you going to continue to rebel? That leads to ruin. Or are you going to find refuge in the ruling King Jesus? And if you're going to find refuge, then you have to kiss the Son. In other words, you have to stop holding on to your way and your life and your stuff and your sin and your desires, stop, bow, and kiss the Son today. Submit your deepest reverence to Christ this morning and invite him to sit on the throne of your heart. My friends, perhaps you once said spiritually, you once said, no throne, no crown, no king. But now you remember the one who wore a crown of thorns for you, the one who left heaven's throne so that he could be king of your heart. Would you surrender to him, submit to him this morning, and kiss the Son?